Welcome to Trust Me, the official podcast of the Trust and Estate Section of the California Lawyers Association. The Trust and Estate Section seeks to further the knowledge of practitioners through updates and a wide range of educational opportunities. In addition, the section monitors and participates in the formation of laws and regulations that impact the trust and estates field and represents section members in the governance of the California Lawyers Association. For further information about the Trust and Estate Section, please go to calawyers.org, click on Sections, Trusts and Estates to learn about upcoming educational opportunities and the benefits of section membership. And now, to your host of today's podcast.
This is part two of my conversation with Vivian Thoreen and Patrick Coleman. Their presentation entitled Case Law and Other Changes in Trust and Estates Practice was a big hit at the Fall 2020 annual meeting. In this episode, we'll discuss Levin versus Winston Levin and Estate of Ashlock, both of which centered on Probate Code Section 859, the so-called double damages statute. Finally, we examine AB 327, which enacted new Probate Code Section 21385. That statute intends to overrule part of the Lintz v. Lintz case as to at-death transfers. We pick up the conversation where Vivian begins to discuss the two 859 cases.
All right, we're going to talk about a few cases. The idea being the discussion is now going to be about Section 859, the statute that everyone, litigators and planners alike, refer to as the double damages statute. You know, this past year we had two cases that dealt with 859, but coming from different angles. The first one was Levin v. Winston Levin, and I'll talk about that really quickly. That was a battle between the daughter and the stepmom, and it wasn't a, you know, stepmom of 6 months. It was a legit second marriage for 20 years, but the idea was there were two trust amendments. The daughter challenged them because they favored stepmom increasingly, and she filed 850 and 859 claims. And what happened here is the issue was the trial court, in my opinion, essentially split the baby. He was trying to compromise because there was a lengthy trial, and the trial court found that both women were completely not credible. They were probably just obnoxious witnesses, and they each had witnesses to support their side of the story. And, you know, they were the angel and the other was Satan and vice versa. So I think the trial court felt really bad for the decedent husband and split the baby, but said that the daughter is the one who appealed. She got most of what she wanted, but she appealed anyway and said, look, you invalidated one of the amendments on the ground of undue influence. And if I have undue influence, that's a way that I can establish elder abuse. And under 859, if I prove elder abuse, then I get double damages. So give those to me. And the trial court said, well, you know, made it this unusual distinction that the undue influence finding, it was just undue influence. But 859 requires undue influence in bad faith. And because it wasn't undue influence in bad faith, you don't get the double damages. So they never talk about the calculation. That was interesting because that, I think, begs the question of whether you can have undue influence, but without bad faith.
Right. Undue influence in good faith? I mean, negligent undue influence? I mean, what else is there but bad faith?
I can appreciate that comment, and I think it's well taken. I think the distinction the trial court is trying to make is this. It's not that if you have undue influence, if it's not undue influence in bad faith, it's automatically undue influence in good faith, because that sounds crazy. But I think what the Court of Appeal was trying to say is these undue influence cases are very, very close calls. There's rarely a smoking gun, and there's so much circumstantial evidence. And who knows what exactly it is that takes the trial court over the edge to determine that, yes, there was undue influence and to invalidate a document. The Court of Appeal, I think, was concerned with the draconian way that this could be implemented by trial courts, that if it's a close call, if I find for undue influence and there's an automatic double damages, you know, remedy, that's too much. Even though I'm a court of equity, I don't want to go there because 859 is a mandatory statute. That's just too much. And we would never have gotten the result here in this Levin case because it was a close call. The trial court was splitting the baby. But if the judge had imposed double damages on the undue influencing stepmom, that would be over the top. And so it doesn't sound right that you would have undue influence sometimes and undue influence in bad faith at other times. But I think it's just an illustration of the way in which you could end up with this slippery slope. You know, you've got undue influence in bad faith that would prompt 859 damages. But also there's the 259 statute, right, where you can be disinherited. That one you have to show by clear and convincing evidence. And so I think it would just be a slippery slope to get to that point if we found this broad, if undue influence is automatically bad faith. But I admit that it sounds weird to make that distinction.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, the more important and interesting part of 859, I think, is Estate of Ashlock. And the Estate of Ashlock is a case that now cements a circuit split if we didn't think there was one previously. And the significance of Estate of Ashlock is how do you calculate double damages under 859? What happens here, we have a very bad love interest / real estate broker / asset manager who, by the time we read this Estate of Ashlock opinion, we're in the third court of appeal decision. And lots of findings have been made against her. It's the son who brings claims against her to undo basically everything she's done and to bring back a bunch of property into dad's estate. And this opinion, the court had found the paramour liable under 859. And so the court makes findings that she has to return 18 parcels of real property that are worth $5 million. The court finds that she took those parcels in bad faith. So the court says, okay, you've got to give back those 18 parcels. And the value of those 18 parcels is $5 million. So under 859, I'm going to double that. I'm going to calculate the twice the value of the property recovered as being $10 million. And so the ultimate judgment at the end of the day is give back those 18 parcels and you have to cut a check for $10 million. And in doing so, the Court of Appeal here in Ashlock overrules conservatorship of Ryball. That's the case that Patrick and I we talked about last year, where we had a dissolved relationship as well. But Ryball was a fourth district opinion that limited the 859 relief to just twice the value. So it was whatever the damages were, and we double that versus what we have in Ashlock, which is give the wrongfully taken property back and then add twice the value of the property recovered. I think Estate of Ashlock was determined correctly. And what I really like about it are the hypos that the Court of Appeal uses to really illustrate its point. In order to get to 859, you have to have an order that requires the wrongdoer to return whatever property they took. So let's say we have, you know, here in Ashlock, it was real property. So the court orders the return of the real property. That's the prerequisite for getting to 859. If you don't get the property back, you never get to 859. But because of the order, and the order is based on section 856, if you don't get your 856 relief, you don't get to pass go. You don't get to collect the $200 and go to section 859. Same thing if it's a diamond ring. Let's say the diamond ring is worth $10,000. That's the example that the Court of Appeal uses. So you get your order under 856 to have the wrongdoer return the diamond ring back to you. Then you get to go to 859. Twice the value of the property recovered, twice the value of the diamond ring, 10,000 plus 10,000 is 20,000. So you get your diamond ring back and you get a check for $20,000. And I think that's right. When I looked back at Ryball, I think the problem in that case was that the trial court screwed it up from the beginning and kind of hamstring the Court of Appeal. The trial court in conservatorship of Ryball said, all right, the judgment is $80,000, double that. I mean, it was in quotes, like double that, and it's 160. So the Court of Appeal had to look at that language in trying to assess how to calculate this 859 relief. And so I think it just was messed up from the outset.
So I guess one of the things that, and you've mentioned it, even though we all kind of refer to it as double damages, it truly, I mean, the language of the statute is pretty clear. It's the value of the property returned.
Right. Everyone says double damages. The word double and the word damages does not appear anywhere in 859. And here's the other thing, 859, at least all of these cases have in common is that they all agree that 859 is a punitive statute. Even conservatorship of libel, it's punitive. It's not punitive to ask a wrongdoer to return the property to give back what they took from you. That just kind of goes without saying. The punitive aspect is then to assess twice the value of that property that they took in bad faith. That's that component.
Okay, and so, but right now we have a split in cases. We've got two conflicting calculations of the double the amount of the value.
That's right. So, you know, now that we're all off TEXCOM, it's easy for us to say, oh yeah, TEXCOM should just, you know, put out a bill and try to fix that ambiguity, because I think it would be helpful to have this kind of clarification, because it could make a really big difference if you can get 859 relief.
You know, maybe we'll turn it over to the litigation subcommittee and let them work on it. and you know, the other kind of ambiguity out there is the value of the property. You know, what if something happens between when it's stolen and when it's being recovered? Like it's an apartment building and there's an earthquake and it wasn't insured for an earthquake, so $5 million is now worth $1 million. Do you get to double the $1 million, or should it be what the value was when they stole it?
Well, again, Herb, I think it depends on who my client is. I would like to think that I would be representing, you know, the good guy, but I also think there's a component of, you know, fairness, and it would be really unfair to attribute any losses in value to the victim. You know, this property was taken from me in bad faith, but now when you, and I get to 859 relief, which is really hard, and then my remedy is really quite pathetic, and it might not even total the original value of the asset that was taken from me.
I see Patrick grabbing his code book, so I think he's got something to say on that.
So I grab my code book here and I look at it, and it says shall be liable for twice the value, but clearly that people see that differently. And then I've got this Ryball case open, and it says, so you're saying it's one, you return the property, plus two. They actually have 1 + 2 = 3 in the division, in the decision. And then it says to consider this an award of treble damages is indeed an absurd interpretation. You know, these words, I mean, it's, but I got to say that if Ashlock is right, and I think Ashlock is right, I think you should see fewer and fewer 850 and 859 cases, because if it is two times, well, that should encourage most people to try to get these type of cases settled, because that is a significant risk to your client. Not only does your client have to pay the property back, but then pay double as a punitive damage against them on top of that. That should encourage a lot of these cases to settle, I would think.
I totally agree. And Patrick, I would extend the portion of 859 that you read. It's the person shall be liable for twice the value of the property recovered. So you got to recover it first before you get this mandatory twice the value. And I think that's where the court in Ashlock did a really good job of just honing in on that language. By the way, I have found fascinating that in Ashlock, it was a 53-day trial.
Wow.
That's kind of a long time.
Yeah. Okay, well, we could spend, and maybe I'll do a future podcast on 850, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about in that 850 to 859 range. But let's move on to your next case.
So the next case we were going to talk about just very briefly, and it's really to make sure that you're paying attention, or if you need your second round, you can get it, is Robertson versus Sadat. This is a really sad case. When this case first starts, we're dealing with a very, very young couple. They're in their 20s. The husband has a genetic disorder. He has a stroke. He's in a coma. And the medical team tells the wife, your husband is not going to make it, and we're on the brink of death here. And the wife feels sorry for her. She says, okay, well, wait, can you extract his sperm? Because we were going to have kids at some point, and if he's not going to make it, I want to take his sperm and freeze it until I'm ready to have kids, and that way he and I can have kids together. And that's something that he really wanted. And she manages to persuade the UCLA medical team to extract it, and she gets 6 vials. We fast forward. She stores it. She's ready to, you know, go through IVF and the facility has lost all of the vials. And the problem is that at the end of the day, the Court of Appeal says, look, you didn't have the right to extract his sperm in the first place. There was nothing to suggest that, you know, your husband explicitly consented to this. So you don't have harm. You haven't been injured. So she's out. But really the point of this case was for me to ask you guys as the planners, and Herb, I know you're both a planner and a litigator, so you're awesome. But my question is, does this come up in with your clients? How do you address this? You know, this is called gametic material, sperm, eggs. How do you handle this? I can imagine that this is going to come up more frequently.
Yeah, when I started practice, 100 years ago, it wasn't an issue, and now it truly is. So it is something I sometimes talk about. I guess it depends on the age of the clients. I have not added it to my normal questionnaire, but I think particularly seeing this case, it's something I would add. Patrick, what do you do? You have it as part of your questionnaire?
So I just pulled my questionnaire up to take a look at it, and we do have it in. And so we have these questions, and the first is there any possibility of additional children, either biological or adopted? And then the next question is, do you have any genetic material, sperm, egg, zygote, embryo, on deposit with a fertility clinic? And so we have very specific questions in our questionnaire, and we have a very good success rate on our clients completing this before they come in. So we'll issue spotted here. And I don't consider myself to be an expert in this area. I think it's a blend of family code, probate code, and California law. So if I need to, I'll, dig into it to figure out what to do, because it doesn't come up that often, but we do have it in our standard questionnaire.
And if somebody does want to provide for the gametic material, what do you do? I mean, does it go into the trust instrument? Does it go into the healthcare directive? Does it get into both?
Well, I think you want to have a statement of intent. So if you're going to have gametic material and you want to make sure that it can be used in a posthumous conception, then I think you need to have that, and you can have that intent evidenced in a testamentary document. But I do think you want to have that in there, that there's an intent that it be used in a posthumous context.
Okay, so you would have probably a standalone instrument that would just discuss that issue.
No, we'd put it in a trust, because it can be, my understanding of the law is it can be in a testamentary document. So we would put it in there. But it is something that I always verify to double check and have something in the file. But that's how we would do it.
I wonder if it should be in the healthcare directive as well, in a case like this where he's had a stroke, he's still alive. Maybe she wants to be fertilized now, not after he dies. So maybe just to make sure that's available, that she would have that authority as the agent.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think one of the takeaways from this lengthy opinion, it is a reminder that someone's intentions regarding gametic material has to be explicit and affirmative. We can't imply anything from the silence. And so, heaven forbid there be a child after the death or even after incapacity and that child doesn't get recognized. So whether it's in the power of attorney, which I think is a great point, or in the estate plan, sentence, paragraph, however explicit your client wants to make it, I think it does need to be explicitly addressed.
It's a good point, because I guess a lot of us may have assumed that as a spouse, you would probably just kind of have this right to be able to use the sperm of your spouse, but that's not the case.
No.
Okay. We've got, I think we covered the cases. I think there was a statute enacted that you wanted to also discuss.
So this is actually a TEXCOM bill, and I think it's important because it overturns a case, Lintz v. Lintz. And there has been discussion that it's overturned legislatively, this case, but not entirely, because Lintz v. Lintz was not entirely an undue influence case. Let me talk a little bit about this bill. This is AB 327. This has been chaptered. And this deals with at-death transfers between spouses. So you start off with Family Code Section 721, and you know, you always kind of maybe think family code during lifetime, probate code at death. Family Code Section 721 provides that if spouses enter into a transaction with each other, they are subject to spousal fiduciary duties. And they're prohibited from taking unfair advantage of each other. Most importantly, if a spouse secures an advantage, there's a rebuttable presumption of breach of spousal fiduciary duty. Well, so along comes this Lintz v. Lintz case, and Lintz was partially a legal capacity case and partially an undue influence case. And Lintz v. Lintz, what happens is through a series of trust amendments and then the ultimate execution of a joint revocable living trust, this estate plan gets significantly changed. The husband, who has substantial separate property, the result of all this is a change of his separate property to community property. And the revocable living trust, after all the amendments and the final execution of the joint trust, changed the decedent's spouse's interest. So the surviving spouse's interest gets changed from 50% of the assets to a life estate in 100% of the assets, with the remainder to her children. So when the Court of Appeals is examining this case, they're looking at it from two perspectives. One is the legal capacity case, and it has to do with the sliding scale of capacity to execute amendments in a trust, and that's not really what I'm going to talk about because that's not the subject of AB 327. But AB 327 dealt with the other part of Lintz, and the other part of Lintz said that when the estate plan changed through these series of amendments and ultimately the execution of a joint revocable living trust, changing separate property to be substantially in favor of the other spouse, that was a violation of Family Code Section 721. There was a presumptive breach of spousal fiduciary duty. And the court looked at the transmutation, huge lifetime transfers from one spouse to the surviving spouse, and then ultimately this joint trust. And what the court said is that the joint trust is like a contract. It's a contract between the two of them, and that contract, to the extent that it increases the take of one spouse beyond intestate succession, well, that's an unfair advantage that they've gained. They've gained something above and beyond what they would get under default law. And that's a presumptive breach of spousal fiduciary duty. So what AB 327 was a TEXCOM bill to reverse this holding as it applied to testamentary dispositions. Before this, and I've had a lot of discussions with my colleagues on this, before this, the dilemma was spouse and spouse come in to meet with you, and one spouse has substantial separate property and they want you to do joint estate planning for them. Should you take that engagement? If you represent two spouses, they have community property and one has substantial separate property, and you do a trust that leaves separate property beyond intestate succession to the other spouse at death, you've got a presumptive breach of spousal fiduciary duty under Family Code Section 721 and the Lintz case. So we talked about, me and like my gang of lawyers that I talked to said, hey, we probably can't represent both spouses in that type of situation. If you do, you're going to have facts in your file because one spouse might be deceased when this all comes up to somehow be able to rebut this presumption. And you're giving yourself a headache maybe you shouldn't even take on. So TEXCOM decided to tackle this issue under the premise that the holding in Lintz contradicts the reasonable expectation of the public that devising property to a spouse in a trust, that the reasonable expectation is that should not be presumptively invalid as a matter of law, and that's the fallout of Lintz. The second thing TEXCOM brought up is this undermines the distinction, family code during lifetime, probate code at death, and this is taking a family code statute 721 and throwing it into the death context. And it disfavors joint trusts. It disfavors one attorney trying to do estate planning for two spouses in this type of a situation, which results in increased costs. A new probate code section has been enacted, a new statute 21385, that now specifically says at-death transfers are not subject to Family Code Section 721. So I think this is important for practitioners to know, because I think it makes our job easier. And I think it's also to go through this carefully, because it does reverse Lentz v. Lentz, but not in entirety, just the Family Code Section 721 part of it.
Thanks for that summary, because I know that was, when Lentz came down, that was something that TEXCOM was, a lot of members expressed a concern about. Vivian, did you have a comment about that?
Yeah, I have a question. So, you know, Lentz v. Lentz was a unique set of facts that is not that unique in my world, because we've got these dysfunctional family members who are litigating. What effect does reversing Lentz have on just, you know, I feel like that really hampers my ability to go after these second, third, fourth, fifth spouses who are taking advantage of, you know, the deceased spouse. You're just taking something else that I could have used to jumpstart the matter. And maybe it's that most husbands and wives, it's, we've got a lot more couples where this is a natural disposition, and the, you know, thieving spouses are much more infrequent. But I wonder if there was a lot of discussion about that portion of it.
Patrick, do you recall?
You're getting rid of the presumption, but you're not eliminating litigators' ability to still argue undue influence has occurred. You're just getting rid of the presumption that, based upon a review of the facts, someone getting above and beyond maybe what they would have gotten by default intestate succession is a presumptive breach of fiduciary duty. So I think it's left you with a tool. I mean, you lose a presumption that automatically applies whenever somebody gets a little bit better of the benefit of the bargain beyond intestate succession. So you lose the presumption, but you still haven't lost the ability to raise whatever arguments you want to make as to undue influence.
I think that's a fair point.
Yeah, I really thought that if you have that presumption, there's going to be so many spouse trusts that would be subject to litigation with that presumption that it just would have brought a potentially illegitimate cases forward, or people forced to settle because they had a presumption that would be difficult to address all too often.
Right.
Let me give you the awkward Lentz v. Lentz. I had two clients, and they both had substantial separate property. And one client had a child from a prior marriage that wanted to get the other spouse's separate property and vice versa. So they said, we're going to swap our separate property. So I get yours, and I'll leave that to this child of mine, and you get mine, and you can leave it over to your child. So they came to me and said, can you help me do this? Can we crisscross our separate property so we can leave it to the actual children that want it? Well, the other children we knew were going to be a problem. So I said, sure, but I want you to get a capacity evaluation from a clinician to make sure that you're competent. And then we're going to go out and get appraisals, so that we can make sure that we're doing this at reasonably equivalent, if not almost perfectly aligned values. So we did do that, and they agreed to do that, but that's a significant transactional cost that you need to do in advance to make sure you can rebut the presumption. And you know, that's the kind of stuff that I think now we don't have to worry about perhaps so much.
I think that's fair. You know, I admit I have a warped perspective given my career path, and I forget about the many undisputed estates that just go on hunky-dory. So I think that's the right call. But I have one last question. So again, this is kind of like the double damages that everyone talks about. When people talk about AB 327 reversing Lentz, is that's not true then? It's not entirely reverse, right?
It's focused only on one part, the legal capacity, which, you know, that's the whole 810 through 812 framework and the sliding scale. That part of Lentz, I think, it is still good law, and I think it's very worthwhile to read. Probably something, Vivian, that you could speak about more eloquently than me all day long because of trial work, but that part is still intact.
Yeah, I think that's a great case if somebody is looking at capacity issues and how to articulate that to a court, that's a great case to really go through. It really lays out that sliding scale and the impact of Probate Code 810 and so forth. Well, we're out of time. I really do thank both Vivian and Patrick for your time here today.
You're very welcome, Herb, anytime. I'll volunteer, Patrick, anytime.
Thank you, Herb. It's always a pleasure to get together with both of you.
For our listeners, if you'd like to see Vivian and Patrick's entire presentation of all the cases with the materials, and there was 23 cases summarized. There's 8 or 10 conservatorship cases that were decided that are referenced. There's selected legislation, including AB 327, but some others that people would be interested in. The webinar will be available by the time this podcast posts. And well, I'll put a link in the show notes to it, but if you want to try and find it, if you just go to California Lawyers, that's callawyers.org, and look at the online CLE and webinar content, you'll be able to find the presentation. It's look for case law and other changes in trusts and estates, and you can review the entire webinar and get some MCLE credit for it. So that takes us to the end of our podcast today. Really appreciate our listeners. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time on Trust Me.
Trust Me is a production of the Trusts and Estates section of the California Lawyers Association and produced by Foley Mara Studios. For further information, please go to calawyers.org, click on Sections, Trusts and Estates, and look for the Education tab to learn about upcoming live programs, online CLE and webcasts, as well as a broad range of low-cost self-study programs. Many of our guests are contributors to the Trusts and Estates Quarterly, the official publication of the section. Benefits of membership include the quarterly, along with email case alerts and other opportunities to stay current in the trusts and estates field. Please consider subscribing to this podcast so that you don't miss our next episode. And thanks for listening to Trust Me.